Okay,
Okay.
hello, Congressman. My name is Chris, and I have a question about the transition from working in an office to working remotely. How has that been?
It's been a challenge because I have to communicate with a Washington, D.C. office, and there's a lot of this is a stressful time, and so it's hard to always kind of read what's going on with people when you're not there in person. We're not always Zoom calling. I'm over here in my world, basically, in isolation here. And so it can be difficult to understand when I might be too demanding of the staff, or maybe losing focus with what we ought to be doing. So that's an extra challenge when you're kind of trying to manage two different locations with two different functions. My people in my district office, that office is also closed in terms of actually physically being closed. So all my caseworkers are also working remotely from their homes, and so we've had to adjust to this new reality. So working from home, I face the same challenges that everybody else is facing, and I'm just thankful that I have actually, a meaningful work to do, and it's important work, that we're trying to get done. We're trying to maintain communication with people in the district. At the same time, I'm trying to make sure that I'm educated and cognizant about the big picture. Trying to balance all of those things is really a challenge.
Okay, thank you so much. We have a question from a student, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Congressman Mark Takano. My question to you is, what does the coronavirus crisis mean for both financial aid and student loans for college students?
Well, for student loans, where you have a chance to, if you have a federal student loan, to put that on pause as far as the interest that accumulates. There is some talk about maybe some loan forgiveness, but I'm not really certain that that is going to get done in the next few months. So I wouldn't necessarily count on that. I mean, you can certainly let your representatives know, but if you're on, if you already have a student loan, and it's a federal student loan, it's a federally guaranteed student loan as opposed to a private loan. You do have interest-free forbearance, at least through the time of this, through the time of the national emergency. RCC is, along with the other institutions of higher education, getting some funding, and that funding, half of that amount of funding is intended to go to students in the term in the form of emergency cash benefits, people who need, truly have a need for food or even housing. There's some form of that available through the direct aid to higher education authorities. About $54 million was made available to the universities in the area. And the colleges, and RCC is included in that, and it's going to be up to the local, each different school, how that's going to be. Let's see. Can I hear? Or is anyone next? Or can I hear? I'm not hearing you. If I can't.
Oh, there it is.
There it is. Okay, thanks.
I think it cut out on the last end of.
Oh, it cut out. I was talking about the student. So there is funding that is coming to the Inland Empire, to the institutions of higher education, specifically my district, where you're talking about Riverside Community College, or La Sierra University, or Cal Baptist, or UCR. Money has been allocated on a formula. And I know that several million dollars have come into RCC. Half of that money is supposed to be allocated towards students according to how the school decides, and in the form of emergency cash aid to students that, it's meant for sort of nutrition and housing. Some students may have work study jobs, and that many schools are continuing to provide the income for work study, even though students can't work those jobs because of the closures. We realize that students were counting on that. And so many schools are actually continuing to provide work study funds.
Okay, thank you so much. The next question is coming in from Trevor.
All right, Trevor.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Good. So my question is a little bit long, but so bear with me. But my question is, in European countries, the stimulus packages are much more like well-rounded and beneficial to workers and less beneficial to large profitable corporations. And despite like the Conservative Party, for example, having control in the UK, they've still managed to provide workers with 80% of their normal salaries. They have public health care, but in the US, we're getting like a one-time check for $1,200 if we file taxes or have requested the check and are eligible for it. And we still have to cover a lot of our own healthcare costs, which makes people scared to like go to the doctor. And if ultimately like this will hurt the entire population, I'm wondering if you'd work with members of the House on the left side, such as AOC or Ilhan Omar, to introduce legislation that provides benefits to all of the population, regardless of employment status or tax status, citizenship status, et cetera.
I realize there might be some impression out there that progressivism began with Ilhan Omar and Alexandra Cortez, Ocasio-Cortez, and others. The truth is that those of us who've been in Congress in the Progressive Caucus have been working on these things for quite some time. And actually before this session of Congress, I've already been active on Medicare for All legislation. I was an early co-sponsor of the Pramila Jayapal legislation related to Medicare for All. The $1,200, I want to say that the CARES package included more than the $1,200 per person benefit. People can also, if they're laid off from their job, they can apply for unemployment. And Congress has supplemented that normal unemployment by $600. So, that unemployment extends beyond into categories of workers who normally wouldn't have been eligible for unemployment. So if you drive a Lyft or Uber, or you're a sole proprietor and you had your own business and you were the only employee, for example, it's quite possible that you could also apply for unemployment insurance. It's based on your income. And also on top of that, Congress did say that every unemployed person gets an additional $600 on top of the unemployment check that they get. And they're also qualified for the $1,200 rebate, tax rebate. The big regret that I have is that workers who file their taxes through ITIN numbers or ITIN numbers, people who are immigrants and don't have social security numbers, who are nevertheless filing tax returns and paying their taxes and working through those numbers, aren't eligible for the $1,200 rebate. And that's some like 5-6 million people who are on ITIN numbers. And to me, it's tragic that we're not taking care of those folks, but my Republican counterparts in the Senate were insistent that the $1,200 rebate only go to those Americans that have Social Security numbers. I also want to mention the PPP program. The PPP program is the Paycheck Protection Program, hence the three Ps, three PPP. So small business and business owners, they can apply for small business loans through the SBA. Small business is defined as 500 employees or less. And you know, say you had a business here in Riverside that had 25, 30 employees, you would be able to apply for a loan through the Small Business Association, Small Business Administration. And if you use that loan to keep your employees employed through the end of the year, you would be able to convert that loan into a grant, in other words, free money. And that was another way to be able to keep employees connected. And so instead of going on unemployment, the idea is that we needed to give a bridge financially to a lot of small businesses out there so that they wouldn't, one, just fail and fold up and go away, and two, that they could also keep a connection to the employees. In that way, we have a greater chance of once we get the economy starting to run again, that the business does not have to go out and find the employees who knew their business very well. So, and there's also what are known as EIDL grants, which are economic loans that are also through the Small Business Association, Small Business Administration. The $1,200 a month loan that can be converted to grants is something that not necessarily the $1,200 rebate. I'm trying to keep all this straight in my mind. The $1,200 rebate is something we're going to have to revisit again because I don't believe it can be just a one-time deal if we're in this for 2-3 or more months and people who can't work are certainly going to need to have these benefits to come to them, to just be able to eat and make sure they can pay immediate bills. We're also going to have to look at continued mortgage relief. Just like with student loans, homeowners who have mortgages can apply with their lenders if it's a federally backed mortgage, if it's like a Fannie Mae mortgage or FHA mortgage or a veterans home loan, anything that's backed by the federal government, that mortgage can be put into forbearance for up to a year. But people have to talk to their financial institutions who hold their loans. And there is also some protection built in for renters. There are many levels of sort of help to the public, but there are some categories of people that we're not doing enough for, and we are negotiating a bipartisan CARES 2 Act, which is probably going to be introduced and hopefully passed the first week of May in a couple of weeks.
Thank you so much. We have a question from Eli based on undocumented students.
Okay, Eli.
How's it going, Congressman Takano? It's great to have you here today.
Thank you.
So my name is Eli Martinez. I'm a full-time student at Riverside City College, and I'm also a part of student government. And my question is the following. Through the CARES Act that was recently passed, we are aware that Riverside City College will be getting an allotted amount of money for institutional support and student financial assistance. However, the funding from this act is not to be used towards assisting undocumented students. Given that undocumented students and their families are one of the most vulnerable populations during this pandemic, what is being done at the federal level to be able to assist them, if not through the CARES Act?
Well, there are those, I am among the members of Congress who feel that the first CARES Act that we just passed was unfair, that it left out mixed status families. There are mixed status families where maybe one or both parents are undocumented, but the kids are American citizens. I think that those families should be able to get that tax credit, the $500 per dependent tax credit. Moreover, if you are working with an ITIN number, you should be able to get the tax rebate, in my mind. You've been paying taxes. And and we should also do what we can to pause any more detentions. I don't think I should be putting more people into detention. In fact, we should be looking at ways to relieve those detention facilities. We shouldn't be putting people who are already terrified and make them more terrified by possibly having people go into detentions where they're exposed to the coronavirus, exposed to it. More than that, I think that I know that the state of California is looking to do some small business relief that also relates to eligibility for the undocumented community. I'm sorry to say that we're running into roadblocks with regard to how small business relief can filter down into undocumented communities. It's a, you know, it's something that we're fighting for. I want you to know that there's a concerted effort by those of us, and we're very much aware of the suffering that's going on among our undocumented populations in our country during this COVID-19 crisis. Also, I also think that the public charge onus needs to be lifted during this pandemic, that any services, whether it's nutrition or SNAP or anything that undocumented individuals in our country may avail themselves of, whether it's also healthcare, that nobody should be afraid that it becomes part of a public charge which affects their future pathway to legal status. So all of these are aspirational. I wish I could say that that I knew that they were for sure going to be included, but we will have more bites of the apple. This next CARES 2 package that we're trying to do in early May won't be the only package, and I can just say that we're going to have to also look toward November to make sure that you know, that there's a change in leadership.
Thank you so much. That actually touches on one of the questions that I have, and it is, how do you think the coronavirus pandemic will affect the 2020 presidential election? And if the coronavirus continues to pose a threat to public health, how do you think similar fights like the one in Wisconsin will emerge over whether or not mail-in ballots should be used to replace in-person voting?
Well, most of us in the Democratic caucus believe that the federal government should be spending a lot more money, not only for COVID-19 related complications of our elections. We were all concerned about the security of elections in the first place, that the idea that foreign actors could tamper with our elections was always a concern. But COVID-19 has made it even more clear that for everyone fully to be able to exercise the right to vote, and we're talking about senior citizens with complicated underlying conditions who are going to be extra scared to go to the polls. And in some states like Texas, you have to have a medical excuse to actually get an absentee ballot. And there was a state judge that ruled that that COVID-19 presented such an excuse, but it's far from clear how an appeal of that judge's ruling in the state of Texas is going to affect whether or not large whole swaths of the Texas electorate are going to automatically be mailed ballots, whether they have to apply for those ballots. And of course, when you have to apply for a vote by mail ballot, that's another layer of complication for the voter. And that inhibits voter turnout. And we want to make it as easy, from my point of view, we want to make it as easy as possible for voters to be able to exercise their right to vote. And I think there are, I think President Trump and many, many Republicans are very concerned that a high turnout is something that is not going to be favorable to them. And there are allegations of fraud, that a vote by mail is open, that increases the level of fraud. And that is the reasoning for why there should not be an expansive federal effort to support and incentivize the use of the vote by mail on a very permissive basis. So the states actually are responsible for how elections are run. The federal government can prescribe for Congress the time, place, and manner of how elections are run, and we can sort of use that sort of federal angle in the Constitution to address election security. But secondly, also, I think out of concern for expansive participation among the electorate to make sure that a lockdown around November, a resurgence of the virus in November of this year, doesn't inhibit disenfranchise large numbers of people, inhibit people from voting and disenfranchise them. That's a real concern. And I'm not as concerned that elections will go forward. My concern is that in certain states, there could be rancor and dispute over their fairness and a sense of whether or not the individual state elections, which will determine the Electoral College vote, were fair, and whether there'll be a true sense of legitimacy of who the next president is.
Thank you so much, Congressman.
Welcome.
Our next question is coming in from Andrea.
Hi, Congressman. My question to you is, does Congressman have any plans to help Americans with mental health issues due to the coronavirus crisis?
Yes, the CARES package that we did pass did include extra money for mental health. It included money for homelessness. It includes, during the crisis like this, FEMA, which is in charge of coordinating emergency responses, has quite a bit of funding flexibility to get, say, homeless people off the streets. And I know I'm kind of, but I do associate homelessness with mental illness, because mental illness is associated with a lot of people who are homeless. And so I think we're talking about that, that we have to make sure that services are available to people, and we'll need to continue to keep our pulse on the mental health of our nation, all the steps through this crisis. So now, as we are sort of hunkered down in our homes, and as we go through recovery, people are going to need support and services to address mental health issues and to stay healthy mentally.
Thank you so much. Our next question is coming in from Ivan.
Okay, Ivan.
Connor, thank you for participating in this virtual town hall and answering questions from students. Thank you for all the work that you and your colleagues in the Congressional Progressive Caucus have done over the last few decades to advocate for progressive positions in Congress. My question regards that more or less. So the question I wanted to ask you is, many Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents support progressive ideas and agendas, and we're happy to see them represented by Senator Sanders and Senator Warren in the 2020 Democratic primaries. Things like Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, and addressing income inequality were broadly popular by amongst the majority of Democratic primary voters. The likely nomination of a different candidate whose platform might be described as retrograde has left many of these same voters uninspired or even jaded. More so, the ridicule and hostility that many progressive ideas receive from Democratic leaders, like the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, and addressing income inequality, while congressional business continues as usual, authorizing corporate tax cuts and war budgets, has made many of us wonder, is there a place for any of us in the Democratic Party? Will we be forced to leave the party? Because it seems like the party, to some extent, has already left us. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. I want you to know that I after the California primary was over in last month, I endorsed Senator Sanders several weeks ago, and it was clear to me, Senator Warren had suspended her campaign. Other candidates had suspended their campaigns, and I was particularly supportive of Senator Sanders because of his longstanding fight for expansive health care, for a Medicare for All approach. And indeed, this pandemic has sort of revealed the shortcomings of our current healthcare system, the free-willing way that it's all sort of coming to the private sector healthcare system. We don't have a lot of extra capacity for an emergency like this. Hospitals typically have been moving toward reducing the number of rooms that they have and moving more and more care into an outpatient basis. And as a cost-saving measure, this wasn't necessarily all wrong, but a completely market-oriented healthcare system has really left us, I think, ill-prepared for a pandemic moment like this. And so it's a point of irony that that the style of campaigning that Senator Sanders excels at, which is to be able to convene large crowds, was prohibited by the circumstances, and that he wasn't able to go out and energize crowds at the very moment that there is a strong argument for a change in our approach to doing healthcare. I will say that I wanted to point you to the ways in which, you did notice that Senator Sanders did endorse Joe Biden. He suspended his campaign and he endorsed Joe Biden. And they have set up a policy coordinating sort of group between, I think, policy people in the Sanders camp and the policy people in the Biden camp. They're working together, and you've seen Senator Biden come out with a loan forgiveness program of $10,000, and that he would move toward that. He cited the fact that his own son, Bo Biden, had residual college debt even after his death, and that that you know the Bidens, Jill and Joe Biden, are still paying off the debt that remains, or maybe it's the the spouse, but that debt remains, and so he's very much aware of the debt burden that students have. He has not quite embraced Medicare for All, but he wants to lower the age of eligibility to age 60. I believe it's actually eligibility. Hillary Clinton, when she ran, advocated that people be able to buy in, quote unquote, into Medicare, be able to choose for that at age 55. But nevertheless, this is movement toward Medicare for All, and it's not nothing, because I'll tell you, the age from age 55 to age 65 is an enormously expensive time to buy healthcare insurance. And under the Affordable Care Act, you can't discriminate based on a pre-existing condition, but you can set different prices for different age bands. And the people who are struggling right now, who aren't covered by their employers, and who make more money than makes them eligible for Medi-Cal here in California, or you know what is known as Medicaid, to buy a policy at that age is very expensive. So being able to cover somebody who's 5 years younger than the eligibility age right now of 65, that is a significant move forward. And just know that the Affordable Care Act, which is what the president, what a President Biden would try to expand and make more workable, is not nothing either. That's also significant. This presidency and the Republican Congress has done its level best to try and roll back the protections under the Affordable Care Act, such as a protection from being discriminated against based on a pre-existing condition. That is a huge deal in the law, and most people get that. But there is much that needs to be done to sort of shore up the financial stability of the current private healthcare plans that are out there. But we have now a platform on which to build a single payer system. A President Biden could issue a waiver to the state of California, and we have a governor and an insurance commissioner who very much believe in moving toward a single payer system, but it would take waivers from the federal government. So how would that work here in California? Well, we'd want to keep the expansion of Medicaid, and if we have another chunk of more senior Americans from age 60 to 65 now eligible for Medicare, we're talking about how do we really reform healthcare in California to take care of that age group, that's younger than age 60, presumably less expensive. And there may be, you know, like solutions that California can experiment with and other states can. But make no mistake about it, the Affordable Care Act is not a prohibition on or a foreclosure on say a single payer system or a Medicare for All system. You could almost think of it as a transitional platform toward it. And I think that's a realistic way. What Senator Sanders has done is he has made this a mainstream issue. He has, I think we can congratulate him for the impact that he has, actually a significant impact that he's had on Joe Biden. And from my point of view, we are doomed if we don't change administrations. though you are disappointed that your ideal candidate didn't make it through, as am I, I think we have to recognize that we can't make the perfect the enemy of the good, that we didn't get our perfect or more ideal candidate. We can't, and we certainly have to recognize that Donald Trump is far worse than the prospect of a President Biden. But I'm hopeful that that more and more people will recognize that Senator Sanders has had a genuine and significant impact on Joe Biden. As I've heard often said, Senator Sanders may not have won the primary vote, but he won the issues primary. His issues have nevertheless become dominant. That's far from nothing. That's actually very significant.
Thank you so much, Congressman. And lastly, we have two questions coming in from Veronica.
Hi, Veronica.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay.
Okay, so my two questions that I had written originally were kind of already answered through hearing all of my classmates' questions, so I came up with another one.
Okay.
So this is more on the whole immigration aspect. Sure. Of the COVID situation. So Governor Newsom recently passed a stimulus bill specifically for undocumented workers in California. However, I think it's important we address how many undocumented workers are scared to disclose their status whenever asking for aid. And it is the reason why a lot of undocumented workers do not even look for aid in the first place. So how would undocumented folk ensure that their status won't be released from applying for the stimulus package, and how will they know their information and status will be kept safe?
Well, if it's a state program administered by the state of California, I don't think for the public charge regulation that was put forward by this administration is really going to apply for them. And so California is trying to work around the inaction of the federal government. And I applaud the state of California for doing that. And thank goodness we live in a nation where all of the power and authority is not concentrated in the federal government, that state governments can take their own actions. So for instance, there's no educational benefit that I can think of at the federal level, like a Pell Grant or a federal loan for students for whom Dreamers are eligible. But California has made it possible for Dreamers to go to college, has made it possible for them to get work. In fact, we know the irony, what we need to do, I think, is we need to tell the stories of all of the healthcare workers, the nurses, the LVNs, the CNAs, who are immigrants, many of whom are undocumented. And we need to get their stories out there and tell those stories so that, all of America knows how self-defeating it is to treat immigrants and undocumented immigrants so unfairly and unkindly. And we're seeing terrible behavior within China of Black Africans, and also Americans who are there maybe teaching English. In some parts of China and in Beijing, they've become targeted for discrimination, and the blame has been put on them for the virus. It's ironic because it's actually returning, repatriating Chinese that are more of a risk of the disease spreading around. I don't sense that our immigrant population as a whole is being scapegoated in that way. I do see our Asian American, our Asian immigrants definitely at risk, at higher risk, because of the way that this president and others have been talking about Asian immigrants. So there's another thing I want to tell you about immigrants being afraid to take advantage of, say, the California benefits. I would encourage them to do so, but I also want to encourage everyone to be involved in the census. You can do it online, and everybody can participate in the census, including undocumented people. We need to count everybody in this area because so much relies on it. How federal funds flow into our areas is determined by not citizens, but the total count of the people. And I'm really concerned that immigrants and undocumented immigrants are afraid of answering the census because they're afraid that their information is going to be shared. Specifically in the law, the census law, that is illegal. Their information cannot be used for anything else. And besides which, it's really important for everybody to answer the census. And we're behind. Ordinarily, we'd have people going out canvassing door to door to get people to answer the census. And of course, that's not possible right now. So please take advantage of the California programs that are available to undocumented people, and also answer the census.
Thank you.
Do you have a second question? Is that?
No, my two other questions were answered already. So just that one question.
I hope my answers weren't too long. Okay, what up?
They were great answers. Thank you, Congressman. And finally, I have one last question for you. I've heard rumors that you've been baking bread. How has that been going?
Look, so I don't know. There's this craze going on out there about baking sourdough bread. And actually the idea of trying to harvest microorganisms that are in the air, like wild yeast, somehow really appealed to me. And I like a challenge of I want nothing to do with making cheese, for example. I mean, cheese making does not appeal to me, even though also it involves microorganisms, good ones. So we are dealing with like really scary, bad, evil microorganisms like the coronavirus. But it's good to know that, you know, we have friendly, beneficial, you know, microorganisms as well. And I've always liked sourdough bread, but I'm in this dilemma because, you know, getting the supplies to make this bread is really more of a problem. Trying to find flour is kind of an issue. And I've been making a lot of food and been sharing that, you know, on my personal Facebook page. And it's created a lot of communication with people who also like to cook. And I know that when people are home, this is one way that many, many people find a way to kind of relieve the stress and find something creative to do that's pleasant and makes the house smell nice. So it's a long answer to, I've only got 2 weeks before I'm supposed to go back to Washington. And I'm worried if I press the order button on Amazon.com that the order is going to come back like a few days before I have to go back to Washington. And then I have all this bread making supplies that I can't use. And then I know once I go back to Washington that we've lost a lot of time and I have to, I'm going to have to work, probably not even come back. And I number one, I don't want all this bread making supplies that I probably won't be able to use. And maybe, God forbid, if we have a second, I don't know how long this is going to last, right? So I don't know when I'm coming back. So I can't have all this bad bread making stuff here in Riverside and then also have a full refrigerator of food that's going to go bad. So I hate to tell you the sob story and make you feel sorry for me about the dilemma I'm in, but so I decided to put the bread making on pause right now.
Thank you so much. Right. And Lastly, have you seen the Tiger King documentary on Netflix?
Okay. I saw like the first 20 minutes and it was painful to watch, I have to tell you. I have friends in Washington, D.C. who like binge watched it. But a friend of mine posted, you know, so we felt like we all had to be part of what was happening. Many of the people I know, he posted, he says, well, this thing makes me very anxious and kind of depressing. I mean, and then I was surprised to learn that these people are not fictional, that they're real. I mean, it was like a few days after I watched that 20 minutes, I'm going, my goodness, there's some sheriff in Florida that's asking the public for help and assisting the you know, solving the murder of the husband of that, who's that woman?
Carol Baskin.
Carol Baskin, yeah. And I just thought she was too out there to be a real person with all of her tiger themed clothing, and that she was a lobbyist and devoted all her life to this. I kind of, you know, this kind of reality documentary, I just kind of thought it was, I have to confess, I don't know if I have the stomach to watch the whole thing to the end.
Yeah.
So that's my answer. The answer is yes, sort of, but you know, I've watched other Netflix shows that I found more uplifting. I don't think of Tiger King as an uplifting bit of entertainment. I mean, we need uplifting entertainment during this moment, right? So
yeah,
that's what I say.
And lastly, do you have any parting words for the students or any questions for us?
Well, what are you guys watching besides Tiger King? That's what I want to know.
Westworld.
What? Westworld?
World, yeah. Yeah, Westworld's awesome.
Westworld? You recommend that? Is it uplifting? Should I watch it?
It's philosophical. I don't know too much about like uplifting, but it's intriguing.
It's not going to take me to... All right, well, let me just leave you this. You know, I think it's important for us to maintain an optimistic attitude, which is not to say that we pretend things, that reality isn't as challenging as it is. But I think back to John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, you know, who was one of the people that led the march across the bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. I went on his annual pilgrimage a couple months ago. I think at the end of February. I can't remember exactly. I think it was the end of February. It was the first weekend of March. And I was down in Alabama with him. And he's going through latter stages of pancreatic cancer. And he's taught me as a colleague the importance of being optimistic and hopeful. And this is coming from a man that lived in a time as an African-American in the South when we truly did have terrible oppressive governments in the states in the South. And he got his head cracked open, actually. And he's taught me the importance of being optimistic in this sense that that a struggle is not won in a moment, in an hour, in a day, a week, a month, or a year. That a struggle is a struggle of a lifetime. That we're involved in a struggle of a lifetime. I'm not talking just about this coronavirus. I'm talking about the bigger visionary aims. And that if we can't get things like Medicare for everybody or a more universal form of health coverage done in this moment, in this year, that we can't stop fighting for it. And we can't stop fighting for a more just society. And we can't, and what I think is at stake right now is the heart and soul of our country. And that it won't be a battle that's just won in an election in November. It's going to take sustained energy and effort. And it's going to take all of you to be engaged in that process. So that's what I mean by a duty, a moral duty to be optimistic. It's not a superficial optimism. It's one that's rooted in an understanding of history, an appreciation of irony and salt and subtlety, and one that's rooted in critical thought. So, and still, not to allow all your knowledge to depress you and discourage you and to make you despondent, but to take the full weight of that history and all its complexity and still have an attitude of optimism about our project as a democracy, our project to be more just and more perfect as a union. So that's my parting words.
Thank you so much, Congressman, for those parting words. And from PSSA and from other students at Riverside City College, we are thankful for the work that you and your colleagues are doing, not only for this region, but nationally as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Congressman. So like I said, we've been recording this, and now we're going to be able to share with all of our political science students, as well as at really any student within the Riverside Community College District that wants to watch it and hear your responses. So thank you again. And hopefully we can do it again in person next time.
That's soon enough for me. All right. Thank you.
All right. Have a good day.